So Proverbs chapter number 6, begin reading with me in verse number 1. My son, if thou be surety for thy friend, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger, thou art snared with the words of thy mouth, thou art taken with the words of thy mouth. Do this now, my son, and deliver thyself. When thou art come into the hand of thy friend, go, humble thyself, and make sure thy friend. Give not sleep to thine eyes, nor slumber to thine eyelids. Deliver thyself as a roe from the hand of the hunter, and as a bird from the hand of the fowler. Go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways and be wise. Which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest. How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? Yet a little slumber, a little sleep, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall thy poverty come as one that traveleth, and thy want as an armed man. Now if you remember in chapter 5 that Solomon gave advice to the young man on the number one influential factor in a young person's life, and that's the opposite sex. In human relations, there is no thing that is more influential and more critical decision that you make than who you marry or who you are romantically involved with. And so romance and dating and sexual temptation, all of that probably trips up young people more than any other thing. And so if you would be wise, then be wise about the subject matter of chapter 5. But now Solomon sits down with his son, again, my son, and he's going to bring up another topic that is of great importance to a young life, and that is money. And just as Solomon knew a lot about women and was well suited to speak to that subject, then Solomon knew a lot about money as well. Solomon was the Elon Musk or the Warren Buffett of his day. He was the richest man in the world at that time. And if you're going to take financial advice from anybody, it stands to reason to take it from somebody who has a little bit of money. Right. I listen to a lot of podcasts while I'm walking. I listen to YouTube channels. And sometimes I listen to finance podcasts or finance YouTube channels. I don't listen to any of them from broke guys, because I can figure out how to be broke all by myself. I don't need help with that, right? You listen to somebody that has some money. So Solomon has expansive knowledge in finances. And so it doesn't surprise us that money would come up quite a bit as a subject in the book of Proverbs. And just as poor romantic decisions can ruin a young person's life, so poor financial decisions can ruin a young person's life as well. Now, I'm not going to do a survey of money advice in Proverbs. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to deal just with this passage tonight. And in this passage that I've read to you, in terms of financial advice, business advice, money advice, Solomon basically gives this young man a warning about two things. The first is there is a warning against surety. Look at verse number 1. My son, if thou be surety for thy friend. Now, surety is not a word that we use a lot in our common vocabulary. But to be surety for someone is to assure their responsibilities. In banking terms, it's a guarantor, or it is a cosigner on a loan. It is when you guarantee somebody else's obligations yourself. Sometimes surety means surely, but oftentimes it means a guarantee. The first time that the word shows up in the Bible is in Genesis 15 and verse 13. God uses the word when he said to Abraham, he says, know of a surety that thy seed will be a stranger in a land that is not there. Hey, Abraham, I be sure. I guarantee you that this is something that's going to happen. I guarantee it. But then surety is used as a pledge. Look at Genesis 49 quickly. This is the first time that it is used in this regard. And in Genesis chapter 49, I'll not read all of these verses, but if you remember from the study of Joseph in Genesis 49, the famine And Canaan has set in. Jacob's sons have already made one trip to Egypt to get grain. They've ran out of that grain. Now they need to go back. But Joseph had recognized them, had not revealed himself the first time. And he tells them that if you come back, you've got to bring that younger son, Benjamin, back with you as proof that you're not deceiving me. And in chapter 49, they're trying to convince Jacob to allow Benjamin to go back. And Jacob doesn't want that to happen. And just look, if you would, down in verse number, Genesis, I'm at 40, am I in the right chapter? I should be in chapter 43, I think. Let me find it here. 46. No, it's not 46. I wrote the verse down. Where's the verse? Chapter 43. Judah is trying to convince Jacob his father. So look at verse number 8. Judah said unto Israel his father, send the lad with me, Benjamin. We will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and thou, and also our little ones. I will be surety for him. Of my hand shalt thou require him. If I bring him not unto thee and set him before thee, then let me bear the blame forever. Here's what he's saying. He's saying, I will bear personal responsibility if something happens to Benjamin. I will pledge everything that I have as a guarantee, a guarantor, that I will bring Benjamin back. So surety is a means of guaranteeing something. That word is found 5 times in Proverbs. Go back to Proverbs. Look at chapter 11. Chapter 11, look at verse number 15. He that is surety for a stranger shall smart for it. Look at chapter 17. Chapter 17 and verse 18. A man void of understanding striketh hands and becometh surety in the presence of his friend. Chapter 20 and verse 16. Take his garment that is surety for a stranger. Take a pledge of him for a strange woman. And so he's talking about becoming a guarantor. When he says back in chapter 6 and verse 1, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger, I guess it's another way of saying shaken hands. You have made an agreement. So here's what he's saying. He's telling this young man that if you have stuck your neck out and you have become the guarantor of somebody else's debts, that's not a wise move. And you need to go to your friend to do whatever you have to do, but you really need to get out of that arrangement. If you co-sign for a friend and that friend defaults on that loan or is late on the payment, that's going to go on your credit report. Or worst case scenario, they default and you have to end up paying off that loan. Co-signing for a friend usually means that the friend didn't have enough credit for the loan himself, so the bank needs him to come up with some form of collateral, and you are the collateral. Right? Now we understand the economics of that, and we understand that that's bad, that's good advice, bad thing to do, and many of us have actually done that. You have probably co-signed for one of your kids, trying to get them started, their first car, getting them set up, or whatever. And it's not a sin to loan money. It's not even a sin to do that. But the Bible does regulate it. Hold your finger right here. Come to Exodus chapter 20, Exodus chapter 22. Exodus chapter 22, and look, if you would, in verse number 25. If thou lend money to any of my people that is poor by thee, thou shalt not be to him as a usurer, neither shalt thou lay upon him usury. So the Bible allows borrowing money, lending money, but it regulates it. Some dictionaries define usury as interest. Other dictionaries define it as excessively high interest rates. And so it's a subject for another day, whether you could charge interest at all or not. But there was a system of borrowing and lending, but it was regulated. Many of you older ones will remember when you used to go to the bank to borrow money and the banker wanted to know if you had any money. Right? There was a time when only people who had money could borrow money. But they don't look at that anymore. Now they want to know, do you have any credit? What is your credit score? Your credit score doesn't say anything about how much money you have. Your credit score says everything about how much debt that you have. It's actually a debt score, not a credit score. That's actually what it is. Did you know, young people, and it's the system that you live in, so you're not going to change it, you might as well just go along with it. You could have $10 million in the bank and have a zero credit score. If you've never borrowed money, never taken out any loan for anything, then you don't have any credit. Now that's really messed up, isn't it? Huh? Now you need to, so here's what we tell our young people. You need to go to get a secured credit card. Need to start using it, pay it off, use it, pay it off, use it, pay it off. Then you need to get a car loan, right? And have a history of paying it off. And then another loan. It's all messed up is what it is.
Right.
But it's the system you live in, so just go ahead and get used to it, right? So it's not a sin to borrow money, but it's regulated. Now, he's talking about being surety. We understand the economics of that. But in that warning, he is going to give this young man three very practical words of advice that I think that are so, so wise. Write them down. Here's the first one. Good intentions do not always end in good decisions. Now watch verse 1. My son, if thou be surety for thy friend. Now, if you're becoming surety, understanding what that is, if you're becoming surety for your friend, basically what you're doing is you are doing them a favor. You make a guarantee to someone that you don't know, a stranger, on behalf of your friend. Because friends help friends. If your friend needs help, then you go and you help him. And when you go to bat for a friend, you mean nothing but good intentions. But good intentions doesn't mean it is a good decision. In fact, no matter how sincere your intentions are, Solomon says that this is a snare. That's the word that he uses in verse number 2. You are walking into a trap even though you just want to help out a friend. Now, why is this a snare? Why is this a bad advice? Because you are legally binding yourself to another person's debt. Could it be that there is a reason why your friend couldn't get his own loan? Could it be that your friendship with your friend clouds your opinion of his credit worthiness? Could it be that you are biased? Do you have enough money to pay off another person's debt without jeopardizing your own financial situation? If your friend defaults and gets called out on the loan, can you pay it off without it becoming a burden to you because they're coming for you? And your friend may have the best of intentions. He may have a plan already laid out how he's going to do it. He may be due for a raise or a promotion or a wrench on Kodan or something happening, but nobody can predict the future. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, so you go into this situation with the expectation that this is going to become my debt. Now, it's important. Solomon's not telling the young man not to help his friend. The problem with this particular scenario is that you are becoming surety for your friend to a stranger. You see that in verse 1? If thou be surety for thy friend, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger. Proverbs 11 verse 15 says, He that is surety for a stranger shall smart for it. Doesn't mean that you are smart. You're going to smart for it. It's going to hurt. It's going to sting. You may know your friend, but you don't know the character or the intention of the stranger. And you're entering into the contract, not with your friend, you're entering into the contract with the stranger. And maybe your friend needs help, maybe you can just give him the money. Or maybe you could just loan it to him yourself and not charge him interest. You can be generous, but yet still be prudent as well. But here's the lesson. Good intentions do not always lead to good decisions. You won't be able to relate to this, but I can. I have made many financial decisions with the best of intentions. But it didn't always end up like I intended. I had good intentions. But looking back on it, that probably was not the best decision to make. Now you can apply it to everything. Some of you probably gotten involved in a friend's drama and you just wanted to help them out. And then you look back on it and you got burned. Said, you know, I should have kept my nose out of that. You meant well. You had good intentions, but it would have been better if you had not gotten involved. You can help somebody out of pity. It could be you just enabling them in their carelessness. And so you can apply it to 100 scenarios, but good intentions, it's a friend. I'm doing it from a friend. But good intentions don't always end in good decisions. But then here's the second principle out of this. It is that good friendships don't always end in good relationships. Look at it in verse 1. My son, if thou be surety for thy friend, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger, thou art snared with the words of thy mouth, thou art taken with the words of thy mouth. Do this now, my son, and deliver thyself. When thou art come into the hand of thy friend, go humble thyself and make sure thy friend. So Solomon says that if you have gotten yourself into this surety obligation, then you need to go and you need to get out of it. Whatever you need to do, you go eat humble pie, tell your friend that you acted too rashly, you cannot carry through with it, so whatever you have to do, and here is the reason why, the end of verse 3, and make sure thy friend. Now here's what's interesting. We focus on the money side of it, what it's going to cost you, all right? But Solomon seems to say there is a greater danger. There's a danger greater than you're going to lose some money. The greater danger is that you're going to lose a friend. The reality is that the relationship is more valuable than the money. Co-signing is a bad financial decision, but it is also a bad relationship arrangement because there's too many things that can go wrong that can damage that relationship. When you borrow money from someone or you loan money to someone, your relationship with that person has changed. You can say that it hasn't, but it has changed. So suppose that you suppose you co-sign a loan for a fellow, suppose you co-sign a car loan for $30,000. Your friendship with that person now is worth no more than $30,000. Now you say, oh, no, oh, yeah. If your friend defaults on that loan for any reason, and it ends up costing you $30,000, there is not a person in this room that could say that would not affect my relationship with that person. Very few friendships could survive that situation. And you think of how often relationships have been destroyed because of money, because of money. You take two people that are getting a divorce and it becomes very acrimonious now because now we're fighting over who gets the insurance policy and who gets this house and that car and fighting over it, and it becomes a business transaction is what it becomes. Siblings that are fighting over an inheritance, business partners that split because of a disagreement over finances. Churches have splits over money issues and friends that have parted ways with arguments over money. Money is a great tool, but money is fraught with dangers as well. And notice the progression in this passage. Notice the progression of the hand. In verse number 1, there's the handshake of surety. If thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger. But in verse number 5, deliver thyself as a roe from the hand of the hunter, snared in the hand of the borrower. In verse number 10, there's the folding of the hands that leads to poverty. You know, in Solomon's day, if you couldn't pay your debts, you could find yourself in servitude to pay off that debt. The foolishness of becoming surety with a stranger is that you're literally risking everything, including your freedom. And so there's just so much wrong that is with this scenario that this young man has gotten himself into. And chief among all of the problems is that you jeopardize not your finances, but you jeopardize your friendship. You wouldn't normally become surety for just an acquaintance, for just anybody that you met on the street. You become surety for your best friend. But no matter how strong your friendship is on the day that you sign that note, it will not be that strong on the day that he defaults on that note. And what Solomon seems to be saying is that your friendship is more valuable than your finances. Relationships are more valuable than riches. You are not going to look at that person the same way. That loan is going to become a point of tension in that relationship, and it is not worth it. And when good intentions do not translate into good decisions, then good friendships will not end in good relationships. Do you see that in that text? There's a third lesson, though. And that is that good observations do not always end in good conversations. Look at verse number 4. Are you with me? So look at verse 4. I told you this is practical. Give not sleep to thine eyes, nor slumber to thine eyelids. Deliver thyself as a roe from the hand of the hunter, and as a bird from the hand of the fowler. So now we're at a point of urgency. All right? You need to be as urgent as a deer trying to escape the hunter, as a bird that's trying to escape the snare. And here's what happens. We make a rash or a risky decision, and then we walk away and we think about it. And oftentimes, upon reflection, we say to ourselves, I wish I hadn't done that. Right. I don't know what I was thinking. So this young man realizes how bad a decision it was to be surety. That's a good observation. If you recognize, boy, this is deeper than I thought. It's not just about money. I jeopardized a lot of things. But now what you have to do is you need to go back to your friend and you need to have a conversation, a difficult conversation that you know your friend is not going to take well. And the tendency is to sit on the good observation and let it stew in you. But Solomon says you need to now go have the conversation, and you need to have it now. Good observations don't always end in good conversations. And again, it doesn't have to be just about money. There's a lot of things that can go wrong in a relationship. And if you put off the difficult conversation, the probability is that you will never have that conversation. It could be your marriage. You really need to sit down and you need to talk about this. There are some things that you observe in your relationship. But how often does that observation not end in a conversation? And the longer you put it off, the more likely it is that you will never have that conversation. Turn the observation into a conversation. That friend is dragging you down. Have the conversation. That person that you're dating doesn't have a spiritual bone in his body. Have the conversation. So there is a warning against being surety with a stranger for a friend. And it's not just financial. The situation is fraught with danger. There's too many risks, and the risk is too much. It's greater than the reward. There is a warning against surety. But then there's a second warning, and it is the warning against sloth. It begins in verse number 6. And recognize that Solomon has not only changed subjects, but he's changed audiences. He says in verse number 6, go to the ant, thou sluggard. Verse 1, my son. Verse 3, my son. Now verse 6, thou sluggard. Sluggard is the Bible word for laziness. The word lazy or laziness is not found in the book of Proverbs. So the word is sluggard. And I preached several years ago here on the sluggard. I won't go through that. But here's the points on a sluggard. He's prone to procrastination. He's quick to quit. He's a lover of leisure. He's bound to his bed. He's dissatisfied in his desires. He's expert at making excuses. That's the characteristics of a lazy person. Now, I'm not sure about this, but I get the impression that when Solomon says, thou sluggard, he could be talking about his son's friend that needed the cosigner. And the reason why he needed a cosigner, he needed somebody to be surety for him, was because he had been slothful in his own financial planning. We're talking about finances here. He's still talking about it. He's been a sluggard in his finances. That's why he needs a cosigner. I don't believe the Bible forbids all debt. It does warn us about the dangers of debt. I don't believe that it is a sin to borrow money, but it is a trap. The best policy is to stay out of debt or to pay it off as quickly as you can. And we've all listened to Dave Ramsey and Larry Burkett and all of that, and there's great counsel in that. It's amazing how much debt we are in as a nation, how much consumer debt that we have, how much interest that you pay on all those credit cards. We've seen all of that. And most debt comes from slothfulness. Not all debt, but most debt. Whether it is impulse buying, or whether it is living above our means, or buying things that we don't need, or too lazy to get a second job, or whatever it might be, most debt comes from a lack of discipline, and a lack of discipline is a form of laziness. And the particular form for that sluggard here is that he's lazy. The son's friend, he's maybe he's never been taught to work. Maybe he was another king's son who always lived in the lap of luxury and was never made to do things that he didn't like. And maybe that's his situation. But the Bible calls him a sluggard. A sluggard. And I don't believe that Solomon is trying to insult him. I believe that Solomon is trying to instruct. I'm trying to wake you up. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to teach you something. I want you to see this. And if the young man will listen to Solomon, Solomon's going to teach him some principles about having discipline in finances so you won't be a sluggard. So in this morning, there are two great principles. Here's the first one. Foolishness is the father of failure. Look at verse number 6. Now watch this. Go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways. Now watch this phrase, and be wise. The smaller the creature that we learn from, the more humility that it's going to take. An adult is not going to take counsel from a child. A billionaire is not going to take financial advice from a homeless person. So it's going to take a whole lot of humbling to get down on your knees and to study the ways of an ant to see if that bug can teach me something. You mean to tell me that that ant knows something that I don't know? That ant's mentioned only two times in the Bible. The other time is in Proverbs chapter number 30. And God says, study the ant and learn something from the ant. We had ants in our house this past week. And I did not get down in the floor and study the ant. I sprayed insect repellent and I killed them is what I did. And when I cut my grass, I have that bag of ant repellent and I walk around. And if any ant piles, I take great delight in running the lawnmower over the ant pile and seeing them scatter, knowing I'm coming back with some bug repellent. And I hope that every one of you dies a miserable death. That's all I think about ants. Ants are actually amazing creatures. Did you know that every ant has 6 legs? Each leg has 3 joints in it, and they are strong enough to carry 20 times their body weight. You try that. They have 2 eyes that are actually 2 sets of eyes. They have 2 stomachs. The life expectancy of an ant is 45 to 50 days unless you are the queen ant. And then you can live up to 20 years. So if you're going to be an ant, you want to be the queen ant. Here's the thing about ants. He says in verse 7, they have no guide, overseer, or ruler, but provideth her meat in the summer, gathereth her food in the harvest. Ants live in colonies. There is no ant that is over the colony. There is a queen ant, but the queen ant does not run the colony. The queen ant doesn't tell all the ants to get up. You got to go to work. No. Doesn't say you got to go hunt for food and you got to step in. It doesn't do that. There is no king. There is no captain. There is nobody coordinating all of that scurrying about. But without an overseer, without a guide, those ants go out every single day and they hunt and they drag scraps back and they save and they prepare. Somehow they know. There is not a preacher or teacher. There's not a mom or dad telling them what they must do. But they know by nature what they must do. That's the point that he makes in verse number 7. I have always thought that Solomon was pointing out how hard the ant works. I don't believe so. I think he's pointing out how wise the ant is. The ant is diligent because it is wise. The ant has a strong work ethic because it is wise. It instinctively knows something. The industry of the ant is because of the wisdom of the ant. He's not saying go work as hard as the ant. You can, but go find the wisdom of the ways of the ant. And the ant doesn't even need a father to tell it that you need to save, you need to get a job, you need to work, you need to not. But no, he has wisdom. Without an overseer, without a guide, he knows what he has to do to prepare for the future and survive the winter. And that instinctive wisdom, if I could use that, is the driving force behind the ant's work ethics. That's what he's saying. See, the young man is upset because Solomon has stepped in as the father and he has interfered with this loan. But Solomon is saying to these two young men, listen, I'll help you. One, the foolishness of surety, and the other is the foolishness of taking out a loan yourself. And he's not trying to insult the young man. He's trying to instruct him. But he doesn't tell him to work harder or to get up earlier or to do. That's not what he says. All of those things may be true, and he does call him a slugger. But here's what he's saying. You need the wisdom of an ant. If you're foolish, you're going to end up in failure. The biggest problem of his life is not that he's lazy. The biggest problem of his life is that he is unwise. Our mindset determines our work ethic. Our mindset determines how we handle money. Our mindset determines how we work and how we save and how we spend. And so the most important thing for our children, for our young people, when you're setting about it and learning finances, is not to learn to work, but why you should work. Why should you save? And there's so much information that's available out there. I mean, you got Dave Ramsey, I think, is wonderful. Larry Burkett, he's passed on, but has some great works. And there's so much wisdom and knowledge that is available to you. And here's the thing. If our children are taught only to work, then they will focus on their career to the sacrifice of their family. And if our children are taught only to save, then they will focus only on money at the expense of their faith. Our children need wisdom to know what to do, but why I'm doing it. Foolishness is the father of failure. But if this young man will listen, Solomon will teach him another principle. And that is that procrastination is the parent of poverty. Look at verse 9. How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall thy poverty come as one that traveleth, and thy want as an armed man. Verse 9 tells you that there is a limit on how long you should sleep. And there should be a time for you to get up. That's what it says. Yeah. I got up this morning at 3:30. I set my alarm at 4 o'clock. And at 3:21 I looked over and I saw it. I checked it. And I laid there knowing I was not going back to sleep. And so at 3:36, I got up and got in the shower and started. Now that sounds like extreme discipline. But I went to bed at 8:30. Okay? So I'd done been in bed for 7 hours anyway. So it doesn't make it sound so good, you know. I got up so early. No, I actually went to bed early. But set a limit for how long you're going to stay in bed. And don't let the bed rob you of opportunity. And we could put anything in there. If I wanted to spiritualize it, I could put video games in there, I could put all of that in there. Whatever you're doing that you should not be doing, that's robbing you of your life. A lack of wisdom will lead to a lack of discipline. A lack of discipline will lead to a lack of food. And Solomon said that poverty is going to come when you put no parameters on sleep. He says that poverty will come suddenly as a traveler, as one that traveleth. I've always wondered, what does that mean, one that traveleth? Here's the only way that I can figure it out. You're sitting in your house. It's 6 o'clock in the evening. You are just getting ready to eat dinner, and it's just you and your family. So it's not in showcase, showroom condition. It's got the lived-in look, okay? You know, the towels are on the couch. You haven't folded yet, and there's toys on the floor. And so it's not terribly messy, but it just... There comes a knock on the door. You are not expecting company. Huh? Who could that be? And it's relatives from Kentucky. They're here. Unannounced. Whether you want company or not. Come on in. It's a traveler. That's what I was talking about. Unannounced. And then it says that poverty will come as an armed man. You're not stopping him. Undeterred. He's coming. Now great poverty, here's the point, I'm done, comes because of a little procrastination. Look at the verse in verse number 10. Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little 40. Boy, he uses that word three times to get our attention. It doesn't take much undiscipline to waste a life. Yeah, right. Little liberties, little leeways. Being a little bit late is not a little thing. Right. When you interview for your job, if you told your boss, and listen, I have a hard time getting up in the morning. Just want you to know you can probably expect me maybe about 15, 20 minutes late about three times a week. He probably wouldn't hire you. Or if he did hire you, that might would slow down the promotions and the raises. Sure. Your little sleep and your little slumber is going to bring you to great poverty. The young man lacks discipline because he lacks wisdom, and because he lacks diligence because he lacks wisdom, and he sees no danger in just a little bit of sleep. His procrastination is lazy, but his greatest problem is that he is unwise. Right. And Solomon says, if you knew this, the implications and how great the implications are, you would change your ways. There's a warning against surety and a warning against... There is much financial advice in this book. And one of the ways to study Proverbs is to go through the book and catalog all of the counsel that it gives on money. And it is so wise. But here's just two words. Don't be surety and don't be slothful. There's a lot of people that have wasted a lot of their life with poor money skills, poor management, slothfulness. Money is so important, but money is so dangerous. You need it in your hand, but don't ever get it in your heart. Make all that you can, save all that you can, and give all that you can. Isn't that great advice in that chapter? Great advice. Very practical. It is something that every young person could walk out of here and say, I am going to put those two things in practice into my life.